This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Well, today on Dreamland, we have a new direction to go in, the beginning of one. We've talked to many experiencers over the course of this show's life since 1998, hundreds, maybe more. But today's experiencer is a different kind of experiencer in a way. He comes from a military background and in a defense-related background, and he has yet come out and said, I'm a close encounter witness. We're going to talk about that, and hopefully over the next few months, more close encounter witnesses who have similar backgrounds will come on Dreamland and talk to us experiencers. I'd like to welcome Dr. John Blitch to the show. He has had an extraordinary career. I would say it is a career in life-saving and helping others, basically. Dr. Blitch is a cognitive psychologist. He is presently a senior research scientist at the 7-11th Human Performance Wing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, in cognitive psychology and neuroscience. His focus is autonomy in human-robot interaction and the training of unmanned system operators and supervisors. He has had 5 tactical command tours in nuclear artillery, special operations, hostage rescue. He's been involved in DARPA and has been present after the World Trade Center attacks in 2001, Oklahoma City, and during the Katrina rescues. And I would like to welcome you now to the show, John. Here's a man whose life focus is humanitarian issues and the survival of people in trouble, and who is also an abductee.
Well, thank you very much, Whitley. That was really something. One point of correction, I think. So I'm no longer assigned to the 7-11th Human Performance Wing. I did retire from the Air Force Research Lab a while ago. So that part's a little bit dated, but thank you for the rest of that. That was wonderful.
Okay, well, I'm glad. Let's start, and we're not gonna really go into John's work so much, because this is his, unlike people like David Grush or Jake Barber, John is not, his work experience and his close encounter experience are two separate things. I want to begin, and I'm going to get into the why of this in a little while, but I want to set the scene by asking you something about your childhood, because I know from long experience, and of course I've watched your interviews, so I know in your case for certain, childhood is where this started for you.
Yes, that is what I believe. As I mentioned in a couple of other interviews, I do have quite a few terrifying dreams that I considered to be dreams until sort of the threshold event that I could no longer dismiss as a dream because it was independently corroborated. So as a scientist, I can't dismiss that as dreams anymore. So yes, I did have quite a few interesting activities, I guess, or interesting experiences as a kid.
A dream that wasn't a dream. That's what a lot of experiencers call that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about, there was one in particular that I've heard you mention before, when there was something or someone looking in the window at you. Can you go back to that one?
Yeah. So the most terrifying aspect of this, and you've discussed this many times, are those dark eyes staring through the window or getting very close to you, like, you know, literally in your face or in your grill, as we would say in the special ops community. And I, you know, looking back on all this after 65 orbits around the sun, approaching 66 here next month, that there's it seems to me that it's a control mechanism, that there's some sort of directed energy that is coming from those eyes, whatever is behind those eyes, that is paralytic in nature, but it's selective. And what I know now from my career with the Air Force Research Lab and CogSci and dabbling in neuroscience is that with directed energy, you know, you can selectively influence different parts of the brain. So it's not inconceivable for me to believe a lot of the literature, the so-called woo-woo literature. So I talk about the woo-woo abduction literature, right? I know we've both read quite a bit about.
Well, I've written some of it myself, so yeah.
Absolutely, I give a lot of it by yourself. I got all your books. And so that's in my, if we were in my basement, my library that's still under construction, I have all those books on one side, and then I have all my peer-reviewed classic science books, you know, my dad's physics books, my physics books, all the chemistry, all that stuff from engineering days. And so what I'm finding now is there's a big overlap in these. And a lot of folks are surprised, you know, the folks that have been read in, Dave and Lou Elizondo and Jake, and they don't see my jaw drop when they talk about, from their perspective, earth-shattering events, like this notion that these beings through their eyes might be able to project directed energy and paralyze us somehow. So there's plenty of evidence of that, right? And it makes all the sense in the world as an efficiency mechanism, right? So rather than floating you out of your bed like they did with a lot of children, as you get older and your brain develops enough, then what they can do is selectively paralyze you and then free up the motor control area, which is typically along the top of your cortex up here. The motor cortex runs pretty much in the middle of your brain on a band like that. So that's what I believe now based on all of my training. But that was the most terrifying aspect. Those eyes that could absolutely paralyze me.
Yeah, you're speaking here to the converted, because yeah. Probably most of the listeners of this show have had that experience, or many of them. And of course, I have too. And it's very disturbing because it can go even deeper. It feels like they can penetrate into your being. Look inside you. And how do you respond to that? Have you ever had that feeling when you were a child, you looked into their eyes, I think, or at least you had a dream that suggested that.
Absolutely. And there were, you know, looking at this scientifically from a behavioral science aspect, and a lot of us feel this way, that we thought all kids acted like this, right? And it's not until you have more social interactions with people and then you realize, well, not every kid has these nightmares about these big-eyed bugs. So examples of anomalous behavior for me, terrified of deer and squirrels. Why? Because of the solid black eyes with no pupil in them. And deer are prey animals. They're afraid of everything, right? So why would I be afraid of something that's afraid of everybody else? Clearly, deer are more afraid of me than I am of them. But it was those solid, dark eyes that would just terrify me. And so my parents were kind of, what's going on here? This doesn't really make sense. So there's one aspect of childhood that was very anomalous. What, this kid is afraid of Bambi? What the heck is going on here, right?
Yeah, well, I was afraid of Mr. Peanut for the same
Mr.
reason.
Peanut. Oh, there's yes. Parents,
what are you doing, Mr. Peanut? Go away. We don't respect your fear. Now you grew up next near a nuclear reactor site, as I recall from you.
Well, so I was born next to a nuclear reactor site.
Yeah.
And my dad moved us as soon as I was old enough to move. So this was 1959. And it wasn't, moving then wasn't as easy as moving now. There was a lot of, and child care for my mom was a big deal, right? And so it took him, I think we moved about 6 months after that. And then my dad went to work shortly for Bendix Corporation. I think it was in Bakersfield, California. So we moved from Idaho Falls to Bakersfield. And then my older sister had a very traumatic experience. Her best friend was run over by a semi-tractor trailer right in front of our house and dragged down the street.
Oh, my God.
And so, I think that contributed to us moving again very quickly thereafter. And we went to, I think we lived for about a year or so with my dad's dad in Tallahassee, Florida, where my younger sister was born. And then we finally settled down up in Boston. My dad got a job with MIT. He was a professor, got a job with Draper Laboratories, and he was an adjunct professor, I guess. He had three master's degrees, which in those days was sufficient to become a professor. Nowadays, you really can't teach much of anywhere without a PhD.
Right.
But he had plenty of technical background. And so I actually grew up in the Boston area. I don't have a lot of memory, obviously, 6 months old, of Idaho Falls, of any of that. But he was very upset one day when they had a drill, an emergency response drill, where they were practicing that something bad had happened inside the reactor. And he went running out to the guard shack, and the guard was talking to his girlfriend on the phone and refused. My dad's banging on the window to play part of this drill, and he needed to call by the checklist or whatever. And the guy just refused to let him use the phone. So he said that was it. Now, that's the story he always told me. I wonder if there was some other level of intuition that he had, because, let me see. So we moved, I was born in March. I think we moved in early fall of 59. Less than 18 months later, the first nuclear accident, first lethal nuclear accident in the United States occurred right there in that reactor. And now it is memorialized in the book Idaho Falls. It was declassified. Three soldiers were killed almost immediately. One was impaled in the dome, the inside reactor vessel. So a horrific situation. So it was almost prescient of him to figure out that we need to get the heck out of there.
You know, that's fascinating. And it's going to become clear why I was so interested in it in a minute. You were then also involved in at a command level in the nuclear artillery program, which would be missiles. You were basically commanding a flight of missiles.
Yeah. So actually my nuclear career started out pretty much as soon as I graduated from West Point. I went through Ranger School and did some other training, basic officer training for cannons. And so in those days, in 1982, by the time I ended up getting to my first assignment which was in Germany, Cold War, East Germany, West Germany. And I ended up at a nuclear capable artillery battalion. So we had cannons. They looked like tanks. They were self-propelled artillery, 155 millimeter cannons, self-propelled. And we would practice launching nuclear projectiles into East Germany from West Germany. And so I had a big issue with that. I had a sort of a sudden, maybe an epiphany, a wake up while I was walking the gun line at one point. And I do remember, you know, the clouds parting. It was a blizzard in Grafenwehr, Germany. And those folks that have ever served in the army in Grafenwehr, Germany know what I'm talking about. It is bone chilling cold. But as the battery XO, I had to police the gun line and make sure that everything was, you know, straight and strack and so forth. And this blizzard suddenly lifted. It was bitterly cold, and then there's this very bright moon shining down, and I kept a cassette recorder with me, and so I have a tape that I recorded. And I'm lamenting to myself, dude, what are you doing? There are a bunch of people 35 kilometers away, maybe a little bit further, that you are practicing killing with nuclear weapons. And they never did anything to you. They both speak the same language, for crying out loud. It's East Germany, West Germany. What the heck are we doing? And then it suddenly occurred to me, wait a minute. It's way worse than that. Because the radiological effects of these weapons are going to carry into the next generation. So we're not just killing them. We're killing their kids. We're killing their grandkids. We're poisoning this entire territory. So this is ludicrous what we are practicing doing. And so that occurred, I think, probably about 6 months before I was due to rotate out anyway and go back to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And so I applied to become, I really wanted to become an astronaut. That was my main goal. My eyes weren't good enough within the Army. And I've got another long story about that. But anyway, so I ended up applying to the Navy for an in-service transfer and was accepted. To my shock, I took a flight aptitude test, and I was just absolutely fortunate beyond words, total luck, that I got a maximum score on that. And so I landed the one NFO slot out of 14 for that fiscal year. And so I was going to the Navy. I had interviewed, I had baptized my youngest daughter in Pensacola Bay, interviewed with them, and I had my orders in hand. And then this lieutenant called me from the Navy Annex, and he informed me that they had to revoke those orders. That's very rare. You know, there's a lot that happens before you get orders, but usually in the military, and I know you are aware of this from some of your lineage. I didn't realize until I was just watching your interview with Jesse that your dad was in the Air Force.
Right. Well, my dad was in the Army, and my uncle was
Army Air Corps, maybe.
But they were both involved in intelligence work, and my uncle all of his career, and my dad during World War II, and possibly afterwards, we don't know, because he was so tight-lipped. He taught us to keep secrets. He said, you got to learn how to keep your lip zipped, because you don't want to say anything out like most people do. You want to think about what you say before you say it. That he lived that. And we're going to take a little break now, folks. We'll be right back.
The Fourth Mind, Whitley Strieber's explosive new book. The first time alien anatomy, alien genetics, the alien brain, and the alien mind have ever been detailed publicly. Learn how they think. Learn what they believe. Learn what we mean to them. Learn when they are coming and why. Then, in part two, learn why we don't have powers like telepathy, levitation, and healing that they do have. Find out about the catastrophe that took our powers from us. Find out how we can regain them. The Fourth Mind, totally new, incredibly important. Get your copy today on Amazon.
Available as a Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and an audiobook read by Whitley Strieber.
This is Whitley Strieber. Listen to me now from June of 2010 talking to Alan Lammers about an incredible thing that happened to him on the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia. Here you are in South Sulawesi in the little town in the district of Sandu Batu. What happened? You were told something rather strange.
Well, we were told before we went, like my friends that I work with the NGO, they told me that when you pack, because it kind of happened by accident, I went out to buy a raincoat. It rains quite a bit in this part of the world. And so I went out and I bought a yellow raincoat. And my friend said, I'm sorry, you can't take that to Walla Walla. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, you can't wear that color. So anyways, excuse me. So I thought, okay, well, what colors can I wear? They said, well, you can only wear black or white. You cannot wear any bright colors, no bright green, especially no yellow. And, you know, that's all you should bring. And I said, well, what would happen? And they said, well, people disappear.
You will find the rest of that story, and it is brain-bending, in the June 5th edition of Dreamland, June 5, 2010 edition of Dreamland in the unknowncountry.com archive. This archive is one of the richest of its kind in the world, probably is the richest of its kind in the world, filled with extraordinary shows, of which this show is certainly one, this show with Alan Lammers. You will never have heard anything like it. It does what Dreamland is here to do. It opens your mind to the fact that we live inside a hidden reality that we prefer not to acknowledge, but not here. Here on unknowncountry.com, we do acknowledge it. We live in it and we love it. Subscribe today. You can't go wrong. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and get started.
We're talking to John Blitch. Dr. Blitch is a close encounter witness who has also been extensively involved in... You've got a security clearance, I believe, John. Of course you do. Yeah. And but your primary focus has been essentially rescue operations. But I want to go to something that you might have thought at the time you needed rescue from, which is a missing time experience. And that, I think, is what, if I'm not wrong, what began to focus this a little bit in your mind, the idea of being a close encounter witness. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd love to. I'm going to close the loop on my nuclear part of the career, though, because I ended up going back to Fort Sill after that Navy transfer was canceled. I ended up commanding a Pershing II missile battery. So that was an Army missile. It was not Air Force.
Okay, well, let's go there for a while, and I'll table the question I started with, and we'll go back.
Okay.
Because the reason I keep coming back to the nuclear issue is that our visitors or NHI are very interested in nuclear issues, and I thought to myself that you had those dreams when you were living near a nuclear site. And I thought, my God, I wonder if they knew even then that he would be involved with nukes in the future. They could have. I mean, you'd never know what they know. They're very mysterious. And their relationship to time is not like ours. It's different.
Right. Yes. So we, you know, I got together last summer with a collection of what we call nuke ex-brothers, nuclear experiencers, brotherhood, small group of us who have all been experiencers, and it was we held it at Robert Hastings' house because he wrote that book, UFOs and Nukes, and essentially brought us all together. Right, as I was the only one that wasn't in the book that he had met before, but in any case, we asked ourselves that question around the campfire. You know, there's things you'll talk about as a military person around a campfire, you won't tell anybody anywhere else, right? And so we kicked that around, and we all wonder, it's a chicken egg, right? Did we get into nukes before we had these, because of these childhood experiences, and they wanted us for some reason to get in there to maybe influence it in a particular way? Or were we taken because our bodies were contaminated from proximity to it, or because of our involvement? And so we're still, it's unclear, but those are kind of interesting issues to consider, right?
Was Terry there, Terry Lovelace?
Yes, he was, yeah.
Okay, so it was you and Robert and Terry and some others. You don't have to say their names if you don't want to. I mean, I know
they have no trouble with me. Mario Woods, Terry Lovelace, Jeff Goodrich, Bob Jacobs, and Robert Hastings. So that was the core five. And then there were some other folks that came in.
Yeah, but that's a very interesting thing to do. So you guys are well aware of this, of what's going on here, obviously. That's really fascinating to me. I did not know that. I'm going to get Robert back on the show at some point. And
please do. Yeah.
Terry has been ill lately, and I don't know he'll come back, but they're both, in fact, what an incredibly accomplished group of men, also all experiencers, all connected in one way or another with nuclear programs. I find that remarkable.
Yeah, I do too. It's absolutely fascinating. And we just added another member. I'm not going to say his name because I haven't gotten his permission yet, but this just happened like within days ago. He was a submariner. He was a submarine nuclear missile technician. And so he reached out to Robert, and we have embraced him. And so he'll probably get involved in this as well and may come out as another whistleblower. We'll see.
Well, we have a lot of people in the IC, in the intelligence community, who watch this show or listen to it, and maybe there's some who have similar work experience who would like to contact you. So how would they do that?
So I just stood up a new website called Fear Fighter. I think it's still under construction, but I have an email that I use for this particular subject area. I have one they use for robotics and other stuff, but for this particular aspect of fighting the fear of an alien invasion, like just like fighting the fear of killer robots, which is my other side of my life and the rescue side of that, it's fearfighter, all one word, 05@protonmail.com.
Yeah, you're a proton mail person too.
Yeah, a lot of us, I mean, you know, There's this notion that, you know, Big Brother is spying on us, and it's nice to know that this stuff's encrypted on both ends. So a lot of us use proton mail.
I agree, absolutely. Now let's get back to the missing time experience.
Sure. Okay, so that occurred. The most profound one that I can't dismiss as dreamscape or whatever occurred when I was in graduate school, the first time through graduate school. I had completed five command tours. Four of those were in special operations, and I had been selected to go to the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. It's right on the border. So they told me that I was a burned out commando. I needed to work on healing my family after all that time in the trenches. So they sent me to the Colorado School of Mines to study artificial intelligence and robotics. And my buddies joked that the reason they picked me was because that was the only way I was going to get intelligent, was artificially, right? So maybe they're looking for, you know, one of the Elon Musk inserts or whatever. turn me into a Borg or whatever. So it happened while I was there, and it was shortly after I had returned from the Oklahoma City bombing rescue recovery effort. And I had sort of established a, you know, a sort of a resilient PTSD thing. Even this was before we even knew, before PTSD really had a name, right? It was, we called it shell shock and such. I would ride my mountain bike for about 45 minutes up to this park and sit on this, on these concrete picnic tables and meditate in under the you know, shadow of this gorgeous ridgeline of the Rocky Mountains, snow covered, you know, beautiful. I used to consider it looked like the side of a Coors Light beer can, right? So that's what I would do. And so I had done it probably four or five times since getting back from Oklahoma City. And it was, this just was another time. And there was a Indian burial ground that I had ridden by many times. I have some, apparently some Native American blood. My great grandfather on my mom's side took a Sioux wife, and she had, you know, told me some of that background, and I had always been very, very respectful of Native Americans. So it was extremely odd, kind of like, you know, being afraid of deer, this anomalous behavior that I was all of a sudden compelled, obsessed, that I had to get over this fence. There was a barbed wire fence and a gate, and I felt like I had to get over that gate, and to do what, I don't know. It was middle of the afternoon, and so I found myself climbing over this gate, and I get back on the other side. I kind of snagged my shirt a couple places, and finally made it down to the ground. And I was about to climb back in the saddle of my bike, and I realized, you know, that's just not right. You know, you need to be respectful while you're in here. So I walked my bike down and something dripped off of my nose. I thought it might've been sweat. And I realized, wait a minute, it wasn't a hard ride and I was coming downhill anyway. So why would it be sweat? And then I noticed it was blood. And so I suddenly had this bloody nose. And so I walked a little bit further down this dirt road around a corner, and I laid out on this like little grassy area around this corner, and I was out. It was weird. It wasn't, you know, like that. I wasn't tired. It was just a sudden
behavior at this point. And
say that,
recognizing it at the moment, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't recognize it at that point at all. And so I woke up shivering. And it couldn't have been, I'm analyzing this now after the fact. At the time I was like, well, I couldn't have been out for more than what, 20 minutes. Why am I so cold? And the sun's come down. And so I must've been out for at least a couple hours, because now it's after sunset. I didn't realize how far after sunset. But it was many hours, because it just doesn't get, you know, Denver is kind of a desert like environment, but it's not instantaneous. And so there had to be at least 2 hours until the sunset. And it was long after that before it got chilly. But none of that was in my head. But what was in my head was this light that was off to my right up on this mesa. And I was like a moth to the flame. And it made no sense. I didn't get back. I didn't pick my bike up and continue walking down the dirt road. I got up and grabbed my bike and dragged it probably 60, 70 feet up this super steep embankment, almost cliff-like, to get up to the top of this mesa, because there was this collection of bright lights up there. And I, you know, I thought maybe it was a drilling operation because, I'm at the Colorado School of Mines, right?
Right.
And so I had this curiosity, but it was beyond curiosity. I know what normal curiosity is like, and I am a pretty curious guy, but this was beyond that, because even if I was curious, I would have walked the bike around on this dirt road and try to see, find a different way up. It was a weird obsession of some sort. Anyway, I get up on the top there, and after I kind of pick myself up and drag my bike up, I notice what looks like, I guess, a fuel truck. It was a shiny, like long trailer looking thing. It was either a fuel truck or maybe a milk truck. I've seen, milk trucks with super shiny, like chrome external, and I realize now that that's just to keep it cool, right? Same with fuel, right? You don't want fuel to heat up either. Either way, I walked around to the front of this very gingerly. I was very apprehensive, and I remember when I kind of got towards the cab, I looked up, and in the cab was this somebody with a red, like plaid shirt, and that's as much as I remember. I remember from that point, then suddenly becoming terrified, and I felt like some time had passed, but maybe not. I just wasn't clear. It was all fuzzy, and so I worked my way back to the back of that fuel truck. There were further lights. There were a bunch of lights, like off to the front of the truck, where I thought like the headlights of the truck might be. Like there might be some other vehicles over there, but I didn't want to go anywhere near that. So I turned around and went around the back of that fuel truck, and got my butt out of there. And I was sneaking. I didn't want whatever was over there, whoever the people were in those other vehicles that were gathered there, I didn't want anybody to see me. So I was kind of slinking down and dragging my bike through this scrub brush, scrub oak, which is really rigid and stiff, and it was kind of tearing on my legs. And as soon as I got to the road, I jumped on that bike and I pedaled like a madman to get the heck out of there. And so from there, I ended up going down a hill, and I was going to pull over into this ranch house because I saw a light on. And speaking of lights, should I turn this on maybe? It's getting dark here. How's that? That's probably too much. How about, is that any better? Okay. So I go down this hill, and I realize I'm starting to settle down now. I'm starting to get control of my fear, and I realize, I really need to call my wife because it's obviously later than I ever imagined it would be when I stopped for my bloody nose. So I went down this dirt road or dirt driveway, and I was going to go up and ring the doorbell and ask them if I could use their phone. This is 1995. No cell phones. And so I stopped myself because I suddenly realized there's no lights on. There's the outside light that every rancher uses, right? Just to welcome folks in, I guess, or whatever. But I'm not going to wake everybody up. And that was my first real strong indicator that something is really wrong here because it's way late. And so then I rode back out, and thankfully, it was downhill to get to this highway, Highway 85. And by the time I got to that highway, I finally relaxed because now I'm not in the wilderness anymore. I am on a major highway, and there's people, but there weren't people because it was so late. There was only one car that would drive by about maybe every 5 minutes. And this is a four-lane highway. So that's when I started to realize, geez, this is really late. And then I hit the wall. I like bonked. I was exhausted. I felt like I'd run a marathon. So I'm riding my bike, doing the best I can just to keep it vertical. And I finally make it up this hill, and I pull into the 7-Eleven, and there's a police car out in front, and he has his windows down, and I have to walk by him to get in the 7-Eleven because I'm also dying of thirst. I'm super dehydrated. And I go
Wow.
in, and I thought I heard my name as I was walking by the police car. But I kept going, and I went in and got some Gatorade, three big 32-ounce orange Gatorades, and I drank one before I even got to the counter. And I put a 20 on the counter, and I think I just left. I didn't even get the change or whatever. I'm not sure. But I remember leaving with the other two Gatorades and going outside. I left my bike against the windows, and the cop gets out of the car and comes up and says, excuse me, sir, is your name John Blitch? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, well, I just want to let you know your wife has called out a missing persons report. And what I'd like to do is just, I'm going to call in that I've found you. And if you're up for it, I'd like to offer you a ride home. Now, usually, you know, the athlete's ego is, there's no way I'm taking a ride home from you, dude, right? But what I really said was, thank God. So I did. And he drove me home. And that was it. That was that event. That was that missing time. I don't know what time I got home. I did go look, not immediately, not until last year. I didn't even think of looking for a police report, but I did go back last year and they couldn't find anything. Highlands Ranch, which used to be just this tiny little, wasn't even a township. Now it's exploded. It's a city, and there's just too many police reports. They've purged everything, so I couldn't find it.
You'd never find it now, no.
Probably not.
We're going to take another break. We'll be right back.
The Fourth Mind, Whitley Strieber's explosive new book. The first time alien anatomy, alien genetics, the alien brain, and the alien mind have ever been detailed publicly. Learn how they think. Learn what they believe. Learn what we mean to them. Learn when they are coming and why. Then, in part two, learn why we don't have powers like telepathy, levitation, and healing that they do have. Find out about the catastrophe that took our powers from us. Find out how we can regain them. The Fourth Mind. Totally new. Incredibly important. Get your copy today on Amazon. Available as a Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and an audiobook read by Whitley Strieber.
Where is the unknown country? Is it out there in the stars? Or is it also somewhere else? Is it in us, in you? Unknown country, join us today. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and join us. Join the questions. Join the search. Join the adventure. Unknowncountry.com. There's no place like it in the world.
We're talking to John Blitch about some remarkable experiences and a remarkable life, a life that has touched the nuclear issue, a life devoted to helping others, and a life that has been interrupted at times in some fairly strange ways. You mentioned a red plaid shirt on the apparent. I'm assuming that's a screen memory. Of course, we don't know for sure. It could have just been, you know, you had a confused night. I mean, you know, but at the same time, there were women who used to show up in these red plaid clothing at our cabin occasionally.
Your cabin?
Yes. I believe that the director of the communion film saw a group of them, and they wore red plaid shirt blouses and skirts, and they looked human, and they had absolutely no emotional affect at all. They did not compute.
Wow.
So,
wow.
I think you might have met one of those critters.
Well, so the plot thickens quite significantly.
Yeah.
Because two other things happened right around that time, and it's fuzzy. It was fuzzy. But the two other events that occurred right around that same time was, number one, I was late to link up with my wife and my older daughter. My younger daughter was with me, and we were supposed to meet them in a mall in Littleton, Colorado. And we ended up cutting through the Barnes & Noble's bookstore. And as I'm walking along, I happened to glance over to the wall of the bookstore, and there prominently displayed were 10 or 15 copies of your book, Communion. And Willie, you've probably heard this 1,000 times from other experiencers. I froze in my tracks. I was paralyzed with fear, and I just stared at that picture right there on that's over your left shoulder. And my daughter, what shook me out of it, my daughter went all the way out into the mall. She turned around and came back. And the next thing I know, she's grabbing my hand, dragging me. She's like, "Dad, come on, we're going to be late." And that shook me out of it. And so then we went and met my wife and my daughter, and they went clothes shopping, and I went straight back to that bookstore, bought the book, ripped the cover off of it, threw it in the trash can on my way out the door. And I think the clerk might have asked me something. "Don't you want to?" And I was out the door. Oh, I'm getting goosebumps. I gotta turn on the heater. I'm getting
Now, were there any, I believe on Ross Coulthard's show, you mentioned a bruising on your arm.
Yeah, that was a separate incident. That was totally separate. And that was, geez, 20 years later. But there was another event that occurred around the same time, this 1995 timeframe. And that was a dream that I now believe was not a dream. And that was this large grasshopper, praying mantis looking being that came in my, what I thought it had come through the screen door on our deck that was next to our master bedroom. It was a third story, no stairs, so it couldn't have been a human, right? I don't know. Anyway, it felt like it just walked right up to me and without even any hesitation through that door. And it was scolding me. It was complaining that I was wiggling around and screaming. And it was telling me, "Quit freaking wiggling. Stop your screaming. We have told you 100 times, we're not going to hurt you. We got to do some work on your body, but your body is just a brain housing group. It's just a soul container. We can't hurt you, your soul. We can certainly hurt your body. We don't want to. We're trying to help you. We're here to help you, but you got to stop this." And as an example of what he could do, his mandibles that were closed, they suddenly opened up, and these big jaws, like ant jaws, started tearing into my cheeks, my shoulders, and I could feel it. I could feel the tugs, and you know, tissue was flying, there's blood splattering, and this was just all mental imagery. And the whole time he was conveying to me that this is the kind of thing we could do to you if we wanted, but we still can't get to your soul. So I felt no pain, but it was like a visceral lesson that he was trying to impart to me. And that was it. That's all I remember from that dream. Many years later, after the morning, the other event where I had the bruises, I did, well, maybe I should tell the bruising story first, I guess.
Tell the bruising story first.
Okay. So that's That all of that that I just told you is what I remember consciously. There was never any meditation about it. There was never any hypnosis about it. Nothing like that. That's exactly how I remembered it all the way up until 2018. But in 2013, I had a very anomalous experience at another time. I was in grad school again. I was living alone. My next door neighbor, great guy, and I had come out of our houses because a storm, or it was a cloud. It was a very weird, dark cloud. It looked like a hurricane, you know, what you see on TV. It had a big spiral, big black hole in the middle, and we're both looking up at it, and he yells over to me across about a half acre, so maybe 100 yards or so. And he's like, "Hey, are you seeing what I'm seeing?" I'm like, "Yeah, it looks kind of weird, doesn't it?" He goes, "Yeah." And it looks like the eye is directly over this lot between our two houses. I owned that lot, and he always wanted to buy it from me because he didn't want somebody else's house to ruin his view. And he was a great guy. I was never going to sell it to anybody else anyway. But he wanted to turn it into a mountain bike park for his kids. And so we talked a lot about that, and we used to mountain bike together, et cetera. And so the weird thing, though, and I know you're familiar with this, it's a common factor in this literature, you know, the invisible college literature where your books are. It's what I call irrational ambivalence, right? There are these weird environmental behavioral activities that for some reason you don't follow up on. Even somebody with a modicum of curiosity should follow up on it.
Right, exactly. That happens to all of us all the time. And people, and you think to yourself, what in the world? Why didn't I say anything? Why did I? Was like nuts. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I call it irrational ambivalence. And so the two of us, we just kind of, instead of waiting for the rain to fall, I don't even think there was any rain. I don't remember any rain. We just both went in our houses. We went back to their houses, and I remember shortly after that going into a procedure that I used to do as a kid, which is after those big black eyes, those horrific nightmares that I would have, I would go into like an OCD behavior, and I would go and make sure every single blind was absolutely closed. The anomalous aspect of it is sometimes I would even go get Scotch tape and tape the curtains so that there wasn't any possibility that they could part. And so those eyes could look at me. It's just weird, right? And then you lock all the doors, you triple lock all the doors, typical OCD-like behavior. Yeah. And then I remember thinking, you know what? I know they're coming. I get that feeling, you know, that there's a shiver down the back of my spine, and I'm like, oh crap, here we go. Yeah. And now the difference between this, now I'm about, I think I was around 50 years old, maybe a little older. And I had this sudden feeling that, you know what, there's nothing I can do. And that's what's terrifying about it, right? And I know you know that. I know I'm preaching to the choir here.
You have to live with it. You've got no choice because it's not going to go.
Yeah. So I told myself, you know what? Never mind trying to hide a knife under your pillow. Or in Terry Lovelace's case, he stole his dad's pistol and put his pistol up underneath his pillow.
Well, listen, I was big time gunned up at the cabin. I had a Benelli riot gun.
Yeah, wow.
Hardware.
Here's an independent corroboration for you. My dad had like 10 guns. I had no idea. After he passed away, I inherited them all. And so he had a very similar sort of obsession with it, you know? And I, it was, he rationalized it that there were bears where we would camp when we were camping up in the White Mountains. We would camp right in that same exact area where Betty and Barney Hill were taken. All the time. Every other weekend, we were up there throughout my childhood. And so he would bring a pistol with him, a 45, a 44 Magnum. And he said it was for bears because, you know, there were some Girl Scouts that got attacked or whatever. But I always wondered whether or not it was for something else. And maybe it was this. But in any case, to bed. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. That's okay. In that area, I mean, that's an area where they see Bigfoot every once in a while, too.
Yes, it's certainly rational just to bring a gun to protect your family, right?
Right. But
why would you buy a new gun every, like, 3 years? You know, I don't know. It's just interesting.
It's guarding behavior.
That's a great way to,
Guarding behavior. I did it too with my family. I mean, I used to sit outside my son's room with a shotgun in my hands and not know why I was doing it.
Yeah, that's a great term. I'm going to borrow that soundbite if you don't mind. I will quote you.
Right. Guarding
behavior. That's perfect. Absolutely right. So, in any case, so I convinced myself. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Let's take another little break.
Okay.
We'll be right back. We're talking to John Blitch. It's a remarkable conversation. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.